Numbers, Chapters 5 and 6, the third talk in a series on Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on August 26, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 3, Numbers 5 and 6, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we'll be looking at Numbers and continuing through. We're looking at chapters 5 and 6 today. So far in Numbers, there's been a census to count all of the people of Israel, all of the adult men, in an effort to organize the people of Israel into a military force. Then the Levites were counted, and in keeping with the principle that God had established that the firstborn belonged to him as a result of the Passover, made sure that there was a Levite for every firstborn of the people of Israel. And where there weren't enough Levites, those extra firstborn were redeemed by 5 shekels. A third census was then taken, and that was to organize the Levites into their responsibilities with respect to the tabernacle, setting it up, carrying it, and performing the duties in the tabernacle. So those 3 censuses have all been taken. That was all in the first 4 chapters of Numbers. Now there's a significant break in the text. We have a section in which there are 4 laws that are talked about, and then there will be a priestly prayer. And I mentioned in the first week that we were looking at Numbers that the organization of this book is difficult, and that Wellhausen said that it's the junk drawer of the Old Testament. And so here's one piece of junk that's in here that's hard. It's hard to figure out why it's here, and we'll at least address that at the end. Chapter 5, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper and everyone having a discharge and everyone who is unclean because of a dead person. You shall send away both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so that they will not defile their camp where I dwell in their midst." And the sons of Israel did so and sent them outside the camp, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. Thus the sons of Israel did. So this is the first of the 4 commands that are in this section. This command, as with all of the others except the 4th, they are talking about a commandment or expanding upon a commandment that was already given in Leviticus. In Leviticus, this has already been talked about. In fact, there are 3 chapters talking about unclean people and defining what it means for them to be unclean with respect. And it gives the 3 reasons here. Lepers, and it goes into great length talking about lepers, and those seem to be skin diseases. We don't know exactly which skin disease. The words that are used in this, in the Pentateuch, are we don't know them well enough, precisely enough, to be able to say what skin diseases qualify. But it's some kind of skin disease. The second one is a discharge. My text says it, everyone having a discharge, but it is generally thought that this is a chronic discharge from the genitalia. But again, we don't know exactly what this is describing. We just don't have, that vocabulary is not well enough known to us. And then the third category is anyone who has touched a dead person. So those three category of people are deemed unclean. That is spelled out in Leviticus. The only thing that this is adding to what was said in Leviticus is that it's making it clear here that those people need to be kept outside of the camp. They can't be in the camp at all. So now we've got these concentric circles that go out. There's the tabernacle itself, which is the holiest. Outside of that, we have this ring of Levites and priests who camp there. Outside of that, we have the rest of the Israelites camped. And then outside of that is the unclean persons. So we've got this gradiated levels of cleanness or holiness in the camp. The next command, verse 5. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel. When a man or woman commits any of the sins of mankind, acting unfaithfully against the Lord, and that person is guilty, then he shall confess his sins, which he has committed, and he shall make restitution in full for his wrong, and add to it one-fifth of it, and give it to him whom he has wronged. But if the man has no relative to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution which is made for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest, besides the ram of atonement by which atonement is made for him. Also every contribution pertaining to all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they offer to the priest, shall be his. So every man's holy gifts shall be his. Whatever any man gives to the priest, it becomes his." This is really vague, it seems like, as to what this is referring to. It says... When a man or a woman commits any of the sins of mankind, acting unfaithfully against the Lord. And that seems awfully vague. However, the wording that is used here corresponds to wording in Leviticus, and the context in Leviticus is pretty clear. It's any instance where someone is defrauding someone else. If you're defrauding someone else, cheating them of money, cheating them of any material goods, that's the kind of crime that seems to be in view here. And here we've just got wording that's a little bit abbreviated as opposed to what we have in Leviticus. And in Leviticus, it says that what needs to be done in that case is there needs to be full restitution. So anything that someone was defrauded of, the one who did the defrauding needs to pay that back plus 20%. And that goes to the wronged person. So the guilty person needs to confess the guilt and pay restitution in order to make that right. The only thing that what's here in Numbers is adding to what we already had is, what do you do if the person dies? The person who is defrauded dies. If the person who is defrauded dies, it would go to the next of kin. But what if he has no next of kin? Well, that's what this is taking care of. And what it says here is that money needs to be paid to the priest. Also, every contribution pertaining to all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they offer to the priest, shall be his. so every man's holy gift shall be his. So that goes to in verse 8, the restitution which is made for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest. And that's in addition to the ram of atonement, which is atonement for the sin. So all this is doing is clarifying that restitution that cannot be repaid to the one who was wronged goes to the priest and is for the priest's use. The next one. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, if any man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, and a man has intercourse with her, and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, although she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her, and she has not been caught in the act, if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife, when she has defiled herself, or if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife, when she has not defiled herself, the man shall then bring his wife to the priest, and shall bring as an offering for her 1/10 of an ephah of barley meal. He shall not pour oil on it, nor put frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of memorial, a reminder of iniquity." So this is a special case in which a husband suspects his wife of committing adultery. She was not caught in the act of adultery. He doesn't have conclusive evidence. He just suspects that that has happened. And in that case, there's a special procedure that he's supposed to go through. He goes to the priest, and the priest carries out this rite. It is interesting that throughout the ancient Near East, adultery was considered to be a sin against the spouse, but also a sin against God. In some place in here it suggests that, but I don't see it right now. So he takes his wife, the suspicious man takes his wife to the priest. The priest takes a grain offering from the man. It's barley meal. It's specifically stated that it's not mixed with oil or frankincense. It was suggested that is because those are both associated with joy, and this is a joyless situation. And this oil or frankincense is a reminder of iniquity. So that's taken to the priest, and then the priest starts the ritual, verse 16. Then the priest shall bring her near and have her stand before the Lord, and the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel, and he shall take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. The priest shall then have the woman stand before the Lord, and let the hair of the woman's head go loose, and place the grain offering of memorial in her hands, which is the grain offering of jealousy. And in the hand of the priest is to be the water of bitterness that brings a curse. And the priest shall have her take an oath, and shall say to the woman, "If no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone astray into uncleanness, being under the authority of your husband, be immune to this water of bitterness that brings a curse. If you, however, have gone astray, being under the authority of your husband, and if you have defiled yourself, and a man other than your husband has had intercourse with you, then the priest shall have the woman swear with the oath of the curse, and the priest shall say to the woman, 'The Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people by the Lord's making your thigh waste away and your abdomen swell.' And this water that brings a curse shall go into your stomach and make your abdomen swell and your thigh waste away. And the woman shall say, Amen, Amen. So the priest takes the grain, and he takes an earthenware vessel. So he takes a cup of some sort. He takes holy water in it, and it's assumed that the water is from the laver that's located in the temple. And he takes dust off of the floor of the tabernacle, and it's generally thought that it would be the floor, dirt from the floor inside the tent itself. And that is sprinkled into this cup of water. And the woman stands with the priest, and the woman's hair is undone, so an indication of mourning. And the priest gives the grain offering into the hands of the woman. She holds that, and the priest is holding the water. And then he makes her take this oath. And this is if you put yourself in the position of the woman, this is a difficult situation to go through in any case. And in the oath that she swears, it says, if no man is lain with you, and if you have not gone astray into uncleanness, being under the authority of your husband, be immune to this water of bitterness that brings a curse. But, on the other hand, if you are guilty of this, and you have defiled yourself, and a man other than your husband has had intercourse with you, then the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people by the Lord's making your thigh waste away and your abdomen swell. And again, it's not clear exactly what's being described here, but there's some obvious sign that develops, and it's not clear how long it takes for this to develop, but it's apparently not instant. So the woman swears that oath and says, Amen, Amen. The next section, 23. The priest shall then write these curses on a scroll, and he shall wash them off into the water of bitterness. Then he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings a curse, so that the water which brings a curse will go into her and cause bitterness. And the priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy from the woman's hand, and he shall wave the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. And the priest shall take a handful of the grain offering as its memorial offering and offer it up in the smoke on the altar. And afterward, he shall make the woman drink the water. When he has made her drink the water, then it shall come about, if she has defiled herself and has been unfaithful to her husband, that the water which brings a curse shall go into her and cause bitterness. And her abdomen will swell, and her thigh will waste away, and the woman will become a curse among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, she will then be free and conceive children. Okay, so the priest writes these curses on a piece of paper or something, in ink apparently, and then washes that ink off of the paper into the water. So there's obvious symbolism happening here. The curses are being incorporated into the water that she will be drinking. Then he offers the grain offering as a wave offering, just waving it over the flame of the altar. And then he makes the woman drink the water. And she drinks it. And if she is guilty, then this causes her abdomen to swell and her thighs to swell. And if she is not guilty, then she leaves undefiled, she's clean, and she will then be free and conceive children. So she will go on to be able to conceive children. The one who has been, if the woman is guilty, presumably she will not be able to conceive children. And that is part of the punishment, is not being able to have children. Verse 29. This is the law of jealousy. When a wife, being under the authority of her husband, goes astray and defiles herself, or when a spirit of jealousy comes over a man and he is jealous of his wife, he shall then make the woman stand before the Lord, and the priest shall apply all this law to her. Moreover, the man shall be free from guilt, but the woman shall bear her guilt. And that's just a summary of what it has talked about. This is a very odd thing that God would command. As I understand it from my reading, it was not uncommon to have trials of ordeal in the ancient world. You've probably heard of them associated with the Middle Ages, but they were commonplace in the ancient world as well. In those situations where someone is accused of something, but there are no witnesses, what do you do? And the ancient Near Eastern laws provided for various kinds of trials by ordeal. Generally speaking, in those trials by ordeal, the person suspected of wrongdoing, and adultery is one of the things that frequently occurs in the other cultures, so this is in keeping with what the other cultures do. The woman is subjected to some genuine ordeal, that is, put into fire or thrown into a river, and it usually involves water or fire. And it's an ordeal. And it is thought that if the woman survives the ordeal, then she is innocent. But if she doesn't survive, then she's guilty. This does not exactly subject a woman to an ordeal, but it would be a very ominous thing to have to go through. There's no question about that. But the woman, if she is found guilty, it is interesting, and I do not know why this is, but the punishment for adultery is not carried out on her. The punishment for adultery, as is given in Leviticus, is death. She's not put to death. But she does apparently have the swelling of the abdomen and the thighs. Apparently this is visible to everyone. And she is childless. She will not conceive children anymore. A woman who is innocent, she goes free. And she bears no guilt. She's just been probably scarred for life by the trauma of the event. Okay, and I'll talk more about this at the end. The next commandment, chapter 6, verse 1. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to dedicate himself to the Lord, he shall abstain from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar, whether made from wine or strong drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh or dried grapes. All the days of his separation, he shall not eat anything that is produced by the grapevine, from the seeds even to the skin. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall pass over his head. He shall be holy until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall let the locks of his hair on his head grow long. All the days of his separation to the Lord, he shall not go near to a dead person. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother, for his brother or for his sister when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord." So this is talking about a special vow that a person, it's a voluntary vow that a person takes. Interestingly, it doesn't really explain what this is or why this is. And from that, I assume that this would have been a practice that was customary in the ancient Near East, that the people would already have known what this was all about and why a person would do this. But a person takes this vow. Well, and I should point out, we do have, there are two kinds of Nazarites. One is a permanent Nazarite, one who takes the Nazarite vow and holds to it for their entire life. And we have the example of Samson. He was a Nazarite, and he was a permanent Nazarite. There are a couple of others that may also have been permanent Nazarites. Samuel could have been. We don't know for sure. It doesn't say it explicitly. And some people have said that John the Baptist may have been. But again, it doesn't say so explicitly. So those are permanent Nazarites. More commonly, it would be a Nazarite vow for 1 year. For 1 year, one would refrain from these things, and then at the end of the year, there would be a ceremony held which brought it to a conclusion. Why would one take a Nazarite vow? It is suggested that one takes a Nazarite vow in order to dedicate oneself to a particular cause, a particular task. And some scholars think that, by and large, for the most part, it would be to the task of warfare, that one would dedicate oneself to warfare for a year, just be a soldier. But we don't know for sure. It's not made clear. It could be that one dedicates oneself to God specially, out of a sense of duty to God, kind of like volunteering for the military. It's something that one feels an obligation to do. Okay, but we don't know for sure. There are three restrictions placed on one who has taken a Nazarite vow. One is abstaining from all of the products of the fruit of the vine. No juice, no wine, no grapes, no raisins, no seeds, no skins. The second is that the Nazarite shaves his head or her head. A Nazarite, a man or a woman could be a Nazarite. He shaves his head and keeps it shaved until the end of the period of time. And the third thing is to stay away from any dead person, even if it's a relative. Even if it's a father, mother, brother, sister, if they die, a Nazarite is supposed to stay away and not go and pay respects. So those are the three restrictions. Verse 9 then talks about a specific kind of problem that could arise. But if a man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his dedicated head of hair, then he shall shave his head on the day when he becomes clean. He shall shave it on the seventh day. Then on the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest, to the doorway of the tent of meeting. And the priest shall offer one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him concerning his sin because of the dead person. And that same day he shall consecrate his head, and shall dedicate to the Lord his days as a Nazarite, and shall bring a male lamb, a year old, for a guilt offering. But the former days shall be void, because his separation was defiled. So, if a Nazirite is walking down the street and somebody next to him drops dead, now he's had contact with a dead person, and as a result, he has to be made clean. So he goes through a week of separation, and on the eighth day, then he brings two pigeons to the priest, and the priest offers one as a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. And then he starts over with his Nazirite vow. He consecrates his head again. He brings a male lamb for a guilt offering, and the clock starts again. So if it was for 1 year, and he has this incident where he comes across a dead person, then he reconsecrates himself, and he starts all over on his 1 year. I read in the commentaries, there is a known case in the first century where a woman took a Nazirite vow for 7 years, went for 6 years and a certain amount, I don't know, a little bit more, and then this happened, and she had to start over again. So almost 14 years. And I just kind of as a curiosity, taking Nazirite vows became quite popular in the first century AD. But they made it so that you could take Nazirite vows for just 1 month. So with the shortened time period, it became quite a bit more popular. And then it gets kind of a bad name, apparently, among the rabbis because so many people do it. Okay. Verse 13. Now this is the law of the Nazirite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, he shall bring the offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting, and he shall present his offering to the Lord, one male lamb, a year old, without defect, for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb, a year old, without defect, for a sin offering, and one ram without defect for a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil and unleavened wafers spread with oil, along with their grain offering and their libations. Then the priest shall present them before the Lord and shall offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. He shall also offer the ram for a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord, together with the basket of unleavened cakes. The priest shall likewise offer his grain offering and its libation. The Nazirite shall then shave his dedicated head of hair at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and take the dedicated hair of his head and put it on the fire which is under the sacrifice of peace offerings. And the priest shall take the ram's shoulder when it has been boiled, and one unleavened cake out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazirite after he has shaved his dedicated hair. Then the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. It is holy for the priest, together with the breast offered by waving and the thigh offered by lifting up. And afterward, the Nazirite may drink wine. So the end of the time period has come. The one who has taken the Nazirite vow takes a number of animals and unleavened cakes and drinks. And he goes to the priest. And the priest offers those things as sacrifices, as offerings. And the Nazirite cuts his hair off right in front of the tabernacle. That hair then is taken and is thrown on the fire of the altar and burned. And after the sacrifices have been made, then the priest takes the ram's shoulder and one unleavened cake out of the basket and one unleavened wafer, and those he gives to the Nazirite. And apparently together then they eat a meal, the Nazirite and the priest. And after that, the Nazirite may drink wine. In other words, his he has met the obligations of his vow and he's freed then. Verse 21, this is the law of the Nazarite who vows his offering to the Lord according to his separation, in addition to what else he can afford, according to his vow which he takes, he shall do according to the law of his separation. So this is what he does to conclude his vows, and he is, and this is the minimum. He can take more if he has more to be sacrificed to God. Then, the last few verses of the chapter are the prayer that was given to God, given by God to Moses for Aaron and the priests to speak on the people of Israel. Verse 22, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the sons of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and I then will bless them. So this is a prayer that was given to the priest to pray to the people of Israel. In Judaism today, this is a prayer that is frequently pronounced. We were at a service last time we were in Israel. There were a group of young people that were going to serve in the Israeli army, and they brought them up in front of the congregation, and they prayed this prayer over these soldiers. It's a blessing. It's a blessing that God will, it's a prayer that God will bless the people of Israel, that he will keep, and I presumably that means to protect, watch over, and that the Lord will make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. In other words, be merciful and gracious to you, and the Lord lift up his countenance upon you to pay attention to you. And give you peace, shalom, real peace. Okay. So those are the four commandments that are in this section and the prayer. Now, why are these laws here in Numbers? And why is it these laws as opposed to any other laws? This much seems clear to me, that chapters 1 through 10 are all describing steps that need to be taken in order for Israel to purify itself in preparation for taking its journey then to the Promised Land. So it's purification and organization that's happening in this first section. First 10 chapters. In the first two chapters, they were getting organized militarily. In the next two chapters, the Levites were getting themselves organized, and the tabernacle and all of its operations were getting clarified and organized. Chapter 7 is going to be a parade of gifts that were given to the service of the tabernacle. So more having to do with purifying themselves and getting their conscience cleared and taking care of all of their duties with respect to the tabernacle. Chapter 8 then is going to describe the consecration of the Levites. Chapter 9 is going to be the celebration of the second Passover. So I think all of this is getting things in order to get ready to take their trip across the desert to the Promised Land. Now, why are these commandments here? I don't really know. Milgram argues that the reason that these particular commandments are here is because they have to do with the priesthood and the duties of the priesthood in one way or another. And we've just talked about the Levites, and so he sees that connection. I'm not entirely satisfied with that justification for putting these commandments here. The first one that we read, talking about the unclean being put outside of the camp, there is no much mention of the priests or Levites there at all. And that seems strange to me if that's the rationale for having these commandments here. My best guess is that a few laws were picked that God wanted to expand upon, and that virtually any laws could have been picked to put in this place because they are just standing for the laws as a whole that God had given to the people of Israel. And it's just reminding them, it's here to remind them of, they stand in for, represent the laws that God gave. But in the context of the Levites and priests and the tabernacle that it's been talking about, it makes sense to have laws that are related to these. And why would it be necessary to bring up the laws here? I think it's reminding them that is the code of conduct around which all of their lives have been reoriented now. And it's a reminder of that fact. And it goes along with what I think is being stressed in these first 10 chapters, and that is, now that they're leaving Sinai, they are a different people. When they left Egypt, they were a mob. They were a lawless mob. They were unorganized. They were just fleeing through the wilderness. But now they've been organized. They've been given laws. They've been given discipline, and they are, in their camp, they are God-centered. So they are very different from what they were before, and I think this is part of the reminder of that truth. Now, it's curious to me, why did God not give all the law at once? Why didn't he give all of the laws at Sinai? Why did he give a bunch of laws at Sinai? And now, a little bit later, a few weeks later, he's expanding on some of those laws. And I don't think it's because he forgot. I think that the giving of the law was intended to be an ongoing process. It wasn't just a once and for all event. And the laws are going to be elaborated on and clarified for an extended period of time. Okay, now, why is there a provision, why is there only provision for a woman suspected of adultery and not a man? There are three people who asked me this question during the last week, so I decided I probably better address it. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I'm drawing upon my knowledge of ancient Greece at this point, and I know that it was the same in ancient Rome. And that is that the main, I think it would be fair to say, the main purpose for a marriage was the production of legitimate heirs. That's primarily what marriage was for, producing legitimate heirs. And that was critical. It was critical that there be heirs, and it was critical that they be the heirs of the father and the mother. If this was true in ancient Israel, and I suspect that it was, then there is a problem here. It's the same problem that the Greeks and Romans faced, and that is, and there's this is a saying in Latin that one of my professors used to say all the time, maternity is known, paternity is always in doubt. You always know who the mother of a child is, because the child comes out of the mother. There is no question. But there is question as to who is the father. That is not known from the birth act. So, in a society where it's critical that children be legitimate, how do you know, how do you make sure that you know that this child is the child of the father, of the husband? And the way that that was done, certainly in Greece and Rome, is everything is directed towards making sure that a woman who is married is faithful in that marriage. If the woman is absolutely faithful, then when she says, "This is our child, this is the child of me and my husband," everybody accepts that. So the father is known. So everything is focused towards making sure that a woman is faithful. Interestingly, in Greece, the man didn't have to be faithful, and men frequently were not faithful. And it was very commonplace in Greek culture. It was also commonplace in Roman culture. But that didn't mess up their values, because they're focused on legitimate heirs. And to have legitimate heirs, you have to have faithful wives. So I suspect that's why we have this procedure for a woman suspected of adultery, but not for men. Now, as I've pointed out, some kind of trial by ordeal was fairly common in the ancient world for this kind of case where a woman is suspected of adultery. But in the other cultures, the woman had to go through an ordeal. Innocent or guilty, had to go through a genuine ordeal, a life-threatening ordeal. What's described here is more humane in that it isn't that kind of ordeal. It may be a difficult experience to go through, but it's not a life-threatening ordeal. And elsewhere in the ancient world, there was a punishment that was pronounced separately from the ordeal. There is no punishment that is separate from the ordeal in Numbers. And God is the one who is making the decision, the proclamation, with respect to the guilt or innocence, and God is the one who is doing the punishing. Okay. Now, I mentioned this when we were going through Deuteronomy, but it is very interesting that the law that God gives to the people of Israel does not set up a utopia. It doesn't get rid of all injustices in society. In Exodus, I talked about the laws with respect to slavery. And that starts out the law is a section talking about slaves and how they are to be treated. And Jonathan Sacks points out it doesn't do away with slavery, but it does change the terms under which slaves live their lives. It makes them more humane terms. And the law lays the seeds for the for doing away with slavery over time. That there are elements in the law that are incompatible with slavery. And over time, that is recognized and acted upon. Jonathan Sacks refers to a book called The Nudge, where it talks about this very fact, that the Old Testament law doesn't get rid of all injustices in society, but it it has within it the principles that undermine those injustices. In other words, it gives them a nudge in the right direction. And what Jonathan Sacks argues is there is something that is very valuable about human societies going through the process of learning what some of those injustices are and doing away with them. Okay. I'll stop there. Any questions or comments?
At what point do we determine that the sexuality in marriage transfers from legal to moral realm?
What do you mean?
Well, for example, in these laws, there's, like you said, there's no nothing for the man. Man can be accused of anything or deny anything.
Right.
So there's not a morally legal response to that situation.
Right.
There's no provision for what they do with the false accusers.
Right.
And if the
well, what do you mean a false accuser in this particular case?
I seem to remember somewhere else that if you accuse someone falsely, then you get what they would have gotten.
Mm-hmm. Had
But there's nothing's mentioned here in this. The woman gets this terrible ordeal with the false accuser. They pretend that they're relieved.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important to note there is probably not a false accuser. We just got a suspicious husband. And how does he deal with his suspicion? What's he supposed to do? So I don't think we should see malicious intent here. But go on.
Well, so, and if the purpose of marriage among the Hebrews is to produce legitimate heirs, it kind of strikes me that somewhere along the line, with our understanding of marriage and sexuality, it's extremely moral. It's in the moral realm,
mm-hmm.
such that even to look on a woman wishing you could have sex with her, Jesus has said, "What, are you kidding me? That's adultery."
Right.
So when do we see that? Does that develop? Is that declared?
Well, I would put that in the realm of what Jonathan Sacks was talking about, and that is that over time it becomes clearer what it is that God actually requires from the law. And the principles that direct us to understand that are built into the law itself. But it takes time for that to become clear and for that to be manifested in a culture. Having said that, however, somebody was telling me about a talk that he heard by Ben Shapiro, who is an Orthodox Jew, who makes a sharp distinction between thought life and actions, that only actions are violations of the Torah. Thought life, it doesn't matter. And he was talking, it was in the context of sexuality. So I would argue that the principles are indeed in the law and are discoverable and do lead us to the understanding that Jesus represents, that to even lust after a woman in your own heart is to commit adultery. It's all there, but it has to be worked out. A person has to come to understand that and appreciate that. Now, with respect to how will that translate into laws, I think it's important to note that we live in a highly politicized environment. There are a number of reasons for that that go back to the Industrial Revolution, that go back to Marxism. There are a number of reasons why we tend to look at the world as though if there's a problem, the solution is a political one. It's either new laws or it's government help or something. That's our knee-jerk reaction when there's a problem. That is highly politicized. The Bible, I think it would be fair to say, is not highly politicized. It is striking to me that when Jesus came, he came into an environment which was had all kinds of opportunities for him to step into the political arena and make political statements. And he didn't. His perspective was, if there's a problem, look at yourself. Dealing with yourself is the way to deal with all of the major problems that you've got. And that's a striking thing, because coming from our culture, from our time, you think that politics are the answer, and that's not the biblical perspective. So the fact that God didn't usher in a utopia shouldn't be surprising, because God isn't all that impressed with politics anyway. You could have the perfect utopian set of laws and have a wicked society. And you can have a society with messed up laws that could actually be a relatively righteous society. It all depends on what people are doing within that framework and how they're thinking about things.
So when Jesus says, what's the foundation of the law? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. It's kind of broad strokes.
Right.
But in that community, in the conversation, they nailed it down probably just in their thinking, their writing, their teaching, their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so something like slavery, you would think that they one day just looked around and said, this is wrong.
Right.
And then just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, that seems to be what God was wanting to do, is to place the seeds of that. Mm-hmm.
David, today in Israel, amongst the Jewish population, there's a percentage you know better than I, who are Orthodox and religious, and those who are simply following custom, and that, of course, is present in our country. At the time these people are receiving instructions, getting ready to leave Egypt, is the same social circumstance there, or are we talking about a very righteous group of people?
We aren't talking about a very righteous group of people. And that becomes clear as we go on in Numbers. And I think that's the problem that we see in Numbers is even after God has spoken to them on Mount Sinai, has given them the law, he has blessed them in all kinds of ways, what we see is nevertheless, they are a rebellious people, just like they were when they left Egypt. So I'm sure that there are within the Israelites, there are people who are more responsive to God than others, but to characterize them with a broad generalization, no, these are not godly people.
And of course, none of the original group made it to the promised land. Is that true? Only their offspring.
Right. And I think that's really the point of, that's one of the main themes of Numbers, is they were, to a man, they were rebellious. Even Moses and Aaron don't go into the promised land. Even Moses and Aaron are rebellious human beings, ultimately, and cannot go. It's only their children. And it's not because their children are wonderful.
I just had a thought while you were talking about that question of why the penalty was for the woman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like what you said. That's right. That's very much a cultural reality back then. I was just thinking, it strikes me that a lot of the laws, and I reserve the right to amend this judgment after I actually figure out what they mean, but that a lot of them are not so much, here, let's have this rule that will make society more just or work better or something, but that a lot of it was intended to get them thinking about their relationship with God and mm-hmm. what it meant to, you know, it's kind of symbolic of certain kinds of things.
Right.
And it strikes me as interesting that it's so common, both in the Old Testament and then in the New Testament, to have the analogy of God's relationship to Israel or God's relationship to his people being of a husband to a wife.
Yeah.
So that the adultery becomes a real metaphor for the biggest mistake that you can make in relationship to God, which is to not be faithful to him.
Right.
So it does strike me that one of the reasons why it might be that way is also kind of setting up a picture that gets you thinking about, when you start to think about that analogy then, and how we're all in the position of being the wife to the husband in that kind of situation, mm-hmm. it might be a reason why God would emphasize that particular thing. I don't know. Just no,
that's a good point. That's a very good point. Anything else?
You have said a number of times that various things bear resemblance to practices in the Near East, you know, and that the Hebrews, what they're doing here, bears resemblance to the typical thing in the Near East. And mm-hmm. this is sort of a new thought for me, that what God gave to them for practices within their culture bore similarities to what was going on. In other words, it wasn't something completely new.
Right.
It had the form of Near Eastern practice. But could you comment on the form contrasted with, say, the spirit of the law?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where there undoubtedly had to be a difference there.
Yeah. That has been a change that I have gone through in my thinking as well, because I used to think God appeared to the people of Israel, gave them a perfect law. It was in direct competition and contrast with the surrounding cultures. And he was correcting everything and setting their thoughts right and that sort of thing. I have, over a number of years, I've slowly become convinced that that's not the way to see it. That's not what happened. That what God did is he took the existing culture and then he tweaks it at various places to make very significant points. So they are not random tweaks. They are very strategic tweaks that point any student of that law to underlying principles that are quite different from the surrounding culture. And in fact, diametrically opposed to the surrounding culture. So it's much more subterranean than I had thought, but it is a sharp contrast, the complete opposite, in a sense, of the surrounding culture. And that's really helpful to me, because when I would find similarities between Israeli culture and surrounding cultures, I always wondered, why would God copy those things? But he chose to speak to the people of Israel using the existing language, the existing cultural language. He's just saying something significantly different with it. Okay. All right, thanks.